listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today is Memorial Day, May 30th, 2011. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Heidi Duro, New York Times bestselling author of The Girl Who Fell from the Sky, published by Algonquin Books. Hailed as one of the best novels of 2010 by the Washington Post, a top 10 book of 2010 by the Oregonian, a top 10 buzz book of 2010 by the Boston Herald, and named top 10 debut of 2010 by Booklist. It's a lot of tens. The Girl Who Fell from the Sky received Barbara Kingsolver's 2008 Bellwether Prize for Literature of Social Change. Ebony Magazine recently named Heidi Duro as one of its Power 100 Leaders of 2010. Heidi Duro was nominated for a 2011 NAACP Image Award for Outstanding Literary Debut. She's a graduate of Stanford, Columbia's Graduate School of Journalism, and Yale Law School. Originally from Portland, Oregon, Heidi has worked as a corporate litigator and as a life skills trainer to professional athletes of the NFL and NBA. She's the co-host of the award-winning weekly podcast Mixed Chicks Chat and the founder and co-producer of the Mixed Roots Film and Literary Festival, an annual free public event that celebrates stories of the mixed experience. She's an occasional essay contributor to National Public Radio. She's the recipient of many fellowships and competitions, including a fellowship in fiction from the New York Foundation of the Arts for the Arts, a Jerome Foundation Fellowship for Emerging Writers, and she won top honors in the Lorion Hemingway Short Story Competition and the Chapter 1 Fiction Contest. Heidi's writing has appeared in Alaska Quarterly Review, The Literary Review, Smoke Long Quarterly, Callaloo, Poem / Memoir / Story, the Yale Journal of Law and Feminism, Essence Magazine, and Newsday. The Girl Who Fell from the Sky tells the story of Rachel, the daughter of a Danish mother and a black GI, who becomes the sole survivor of a family tragedy. Interwoven in the novel are the voices of Jamie, a neighborhood boy who witnessed the events, and Lerone, a friend of Rachel's mother. Inspired by a true story of a mother's twisted love, The Girl Who Fell from the Sky reveals an unfathomable past and explores issues of identity at a time when many people are asking, must race confine us and define us? When I spoke to Heidi Duro last week, I asked her to talk about her background, her many careers, and her choice to become a writer.
I had always wanted to be a writer, and I was just trying to figure out a way to become one and actually have some money in my bank account and not worry about money all the time. I mean, very honestly, I grew up very poor. My mom was a single mom, and we were on welfare and food stamps for a long time. And I had this idea very young that I wanted to write, but there was so much insecurity in being an artist and being a writer that I thought, I need to make sure I have a job and I need to get the best education I can. And so I gravitated toward jobs that allowed me to write in them, which meant in college I wrote for the school paper and I did an internship at Hallmark Cards writing greeting cards, which was really, really cool. And I ended up getting a degree in journalism and then realized that journalists don't get paid very much money at all. And decided, you know, I'd gotten into law school, so I went to law school, but went on to the litigation side because you get to write the briefs and things like that. And so this whole time I was, you know, searching for a way to actually be a real writer. And I realized, finally, I was about to turn 30, and I thought my life was going to end at 30, you know, because I was going to be so old. And I quit my job, and I said, you know, I'm just going to keep getting older with or without a book, and started on this path to write this book, The Girl Who Fell from the Sky. It was very different than I started it in 1998, and it just took that long to write it and get it published.
Right.
I could go on and on about all of, you know, all of the other in-between stories too. I mean, there's such a long journey to this book actually finding its way into the world.
Well, I have a couple of questions. First of all, about you mentioned the Hallmark internship. So, is that something that you did because you were located in a city where Hallmark existed, or was that just sort of something you did from home?
It was something that I actually relocated to Kansas City for. That's where they're based.
Oh, wow.
And it was an internship that I learned about from the Career Center at my college and applied for, and I got one of, I think, two or three positions for that summer. And it was such a great job. I mean, really, like, it was an ideal thing for me because I used to be, and still am, even though it's the age of email, I love to write letters and thank you notes, and I love stationery and pens and ink and all of that stuff and stamps. But at Hallmark, I would get these assignments that would say something like, funny sentiment Easter from teenage son to dad. And then you would have to write whatever the message would be. That one in particular turned out to be a hit for me because I got two pieces accepted for that assignment ultimately, and I think they're still in circulation. People, I hope I'm not giving away like a trade secret, but a lot of those sentiments that sell at Hallmark, they actually recycle. They put new art on the cover, and then they recycle the sentiments every other season.
Well, okay. Well, you know what? That doesn't really shock me.
The only reason I didn't go into doing that when I left college, because it was an option to do it, I wanted to be in a really big city. I loved Kansas City, but I really wanted to go to New York and check it out and see what was going on.
Right. Oh, that's interesting. That's what an interesting internship. And then my other question was just about your legal work, and I would think that that kind of writing would be hard on your fiction. So were you able to work simultaneously on those two things, or...
You're totally right. It was a disaster for my fiction. Very honestly, I was not a fiction writer before I started writing this book. I had done a lot of essay writing columns for the college newspaper. I was really a nonfiction writer and at one point thought I would write a memoir, but I was 23 and I didn't have much memory of anything I'd really done at that point. But the real difficulty with the legal job was that it just took over my life. I literally would work 60 to 80 hours a week. There were often times that I didn't leave the office for days and days. And this was a really civilized, you know, high-class office. They had showers on every floor. So when you pulled all-nighters, you could actually go in and freshen up before you started the day again without having had any sleep.
Oh, wow.
So that was the difficulty. It wasn't so much the writing part of it that killed kind of the creativity. It was just the sheer number of hours worked that killed any ability to sit and reflect and think about something else other than work.
Yeah, boy, that sounds exhausting. So when you quit your job altogether, was that scary?
I was so scared. When I told my boss, I cried. I was just so disgusted with myself. I told myself, don't cry when you quit. But it was really scary because here I was, you know, about to turn 30, which we all know is the end of the line. Nothing good happens after 30, right? And I had really unmoored myself at this point. I had always done the thing that was the best thing to do, that's what I always strove to do. I wanted to go to the best college I could go to. I wanted to go to the best journalism school. I wanted to go to the best law school. And there were certain ways you could do this. You got great grades. You did certain activities, et cetera, et cetera. But as an artist, there is no way. There's no map. There's no guide. There's no certain set of things to do to then become a writer or be a writer or be published or any of that.
Right.
It was so, so scary. And for a long time, I just went about kind of flailing about thinking there is no way to become an artist. There is no certain way. And I think I let a lot of years go by without really putting enough into the work. It took me 6 years to write the first draft of this book.
Okay.
Started in 1998, and I didn't finish a first draft, which of course I thought was brilliant and was the last draft. But I I soon, you know, was disabused of that notion, and thank goodness, rightfully. But I had this idea for a long time that there is no way, and there isn't. But then after all of this time, I had already turned 30. I had turned 31. I had almost turned 32, and I didn't have a book. And I set myself on a mission to get something done. And the first thing I did was to read the bios of those debut novelists that I either admired or envied, mostly the ones I envied, because you get a lot of energy out of envy.
Sure.
And I decided I would try to copy their resumes. So I would write my chapters as short stories, and then I would submit them to all the journals, all the literary journals that those debut novelists had published in. And I would submit my work to every contest that they had won, and every grant, and every residency.
Wow.
And at some point, it started to hit. You know, I won a contest, and then I won another one, and then I won a grant, and it started to snowball. It gave me not just the credentials. I started to develop a real resume, kind of looking as good as my other resume had in my professional life. But I had a resume, but I also gained some confidence, and then I gained some angels along the way, people who became interested in making sure I got to the next step.
Now, when you talk about having sort of emulated the bios of other authors, how many people were you focused on? I mean, I imagine you'd have to kind of focus in on a few people, or it would just be a massive task. So,
well, yeah, I mean, it was, you know, a handful of writers at different times during those years.
Okay.
I remember I really admire Monique Trung, The Book of Salt. And so I thought, I'm going to do everything she did. And she was also a lawyer. She had gone to, I think, Columbia Law School and had maybe she didn't practice, but I think she had practice. And so I thought, well, she's someone I'm going to look at and figure out how I could do it. I couldn't necessarily make it happen the way a debut author like Nell Freudenberger, I think I've missaid her name, but she came out with a giant splash in the New Yorker and on and on and on.
Yes.
So I had to go in the small, subtle ways of trying to figure out how to craft a resume that looked like something that gave me some oomph and ultimately something I could write in a letter to an agent to get an agent interested.
Now, it's really interesting because I've heard writers say that they tried to imitate another writer's style in order to develop their own, but it doesn't sound like that's what you were doing. It sounds like you were just trying to follow their steps in where they got published in order to grow your resume.
That's it, exactly. I wasn't so much interested in copying anyone else's style or trying to figure out what the publishing world liked about their work. I very much knew I wanted to write my own book, and I had my own influences already. Just from being a reader all those years, all those books as I was growing up and developing as a reader that touched me most, that of course I hearken back on and wanted to make sure that readers of my book would hear echoes of those writers like Jamaica Kincaid and Sandra Cisneros and Faulkner, if I may say that too. But I mean, I really do love Faulkner, Alice Walker, all of those people. What I really focused on was they were able to get a book published. What were the things they had done before that? And just turned it into small baby steps, so that I wasn't so daunted by this idea of getting a book published. There's so much that you don't have control over, but you do have control over how often you submit your work. This is another rule I had for myself. For every rejection I got, and this is before there were a lot of places that had electronic submissions, it was all through the postage, I would send out, for every rejection I got, I would send out that story twice again that very same day. And I would have all of my envelopes made up and all the postage on. So I spent a ton in postage and supplies. I really did. And I spent a lot of time at the post office. But the thing was, I got a ton of rejections, but I also got to the yes faster.
Yeah, sure. I'm curious if the stories that you were publishing that I believe were parts of The Girl Who Fell from the Sky. Were those stories changed by the time the book was published, or were they were any of the chapters that are in the final book standalone stories that you published elsewhere?
Not exactly, not at all, because a short story has different requirements than a chapter does.
Yeah.
And so everything that I ended up publishing in story form is in some way in the book, but not necessarily in the same order or the same tense or given to the same character even. I think there are a couple of places where I gave lines to different characters. So obviously, like, the good part of writing those chapters is that I did learn a lot about the arc of a short story, mm-hmm. which is a great thing also to have in a novel, to have these small little short story arcs within your larger narrative.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about the novel in more detail. I had a question about the novel involves themes of identity in various ways. One of the characters who grapples with his identity is Jamie. And for a long time early in the book, each time he's identified, he's called Jamie, who was really James. And then he eventually sort of chooses a whole new identity for himself. And I wondered if you could talk about Jamie's role and his development as a character within the book.
I love that little dude, and he wasn't supposed to be in the book at all. He was one of those gifts that you get as a writer. I was at an artist colony in Wyoming. It's called Gentel, and one of the visual artists who was there was a huge birder. He was crazy about birds, and he would say things like, "Heidi, did you see the blue stocking-footed purple polka-dotted warbler on the patio? I've seen two now. I never thought I'd see a bird like that in my life," you know? And he taught me a lot about birds, which I didn't retain at all. But what I kept was this love, this obsession that he had with birds. So there was this one afternoon, and at an artist colony, you have all the time in the world to just sit and write. But I was stuck. I was having this terrible writer's block on a Rachel chapter. And I said, okay, I can't not write. I'm here in this beautiful place with all this time and space and permission. I've got to write something. So I started to write a short story about someone who loves birds. And I thought, well, what if this person doesn't see birds? Who would that be? And I thought, it's definitely someone in a city, and it's probably a kid. Mm. It's someone who has no power in the world. So I was sitting there thinking I was writing a story totally unrelated to my book, and I realized, oh my gosh, he sees the accident.
Yeah.
He sees Robbie. He sees what's happening. He thinks Robbie is a bird. And so that was the genesis of that character. And that first chapter, now I didn't write it exactly like that. That first chapter he appears, I wrote over the course of a day and a half. And I realized I needed this guy more in the book. Because I think it's true in life, too, that when something really bad happens, you need to have that witness. Mm-hmm. You need that person in your life who puts his arm around you, puts her arm around you, and says, I saw that was a bad thing.
Yeah.
I saw it the way you saw it. And I hear you, you know, I see you, I hear you, and mm-hmm. I saw that bad thing. And so I realized that that was an essential piece of what would be healing for Rachel, that she would need a witness in her life. And then the other piece of that character, and this is all stuff that I'm able to articulate now because I have some distance from it and I've had a chance to talk about the book a lot. It's not something I could have articulated as I was writing it, but he became very much a reflection for Rachel in that he has all of this hurt in the same way that she has all this hurt in her life,
mm-hmm.
but he's still willing to love. He's open arms. He's ready to still be hurt if it hurts. He knows love hurts, but he's willing to go there nevertheless. And that's exactly what Rachel has lost at the beginning of the book when she loses her family. She has just lost the ability to connect in a lot of ways. She's too scared to take on love and connection anymore.
There was another parallel between Rachel and Jamie that I just loved, which was, and it actually reminded me so strongly of what it's like to be a child and wanting to be someone else or someone better or someone more impressive, you know, and the parallel I'm speaking of is that Rachel, she ends up in a new city after the accident, and she is constantly dreaming of impressing the kind of mean popular girls at her school. She sort of imagines herself doing things that will impress them and make them really, you know, notice her in a different way. And at the same time, from a great distance, Jamie is dreaming of finding and impressing Rachel, and I think part of this was just about both of their age, but also about their insecurities and ambitions. I felt that that was a really interesting way to connect them in some ways.
I wish I could say that I did that on purpose, so I'm just going to say that I did that on purpose, but I think that's a wonderful reading of it, of course. There are so many things in the book that I didn't know I was doing, although maybe I did know I was doing them, and I think that's perfect and profound, and I'm going to pretend I said that.
Well, the other truth is that, you know, these parallels do exist in life, and so when you write a book well, they're going to show up, so I did enjoy that, though. You know, another way that the book involves themes of identity is race, racial themes. And I did read an interview that you did with NPR. I read a transcript of an interview you did on NPR. And you commented that in your experience, people often want children who are mixed race to choose one way or the other which race they are. And I wonder if you can speak to that, but also if you feel like that's as true today as it was maybe when you were growing up, and if that's changed at all in your opinion?
Well, it certainly was my experience. When I was 11 years old, we had lived mostly overseas, but we suddenly moved to the United States when my dad left the military, and we ended up in Portland, Oregon. And it was such a strange thing when people asked me, and this is in the 1980s, they would say, "What are you?" And it was confusing and it was confounding, because I thought the right answer was what was essential to me, what mm-hmm. was most important about me, which was I was a really good speller. I liked to write poems and I liked to read big books, you know. And those were not the answers that the kids wanted. And they wanted to know, are you black or are you white? And no one had told me about this before. Yeah. I think. And I know people laugh when I've said it before, but the only black person I remember knowing until I was 11 was my dad, and I didn't know he was black. Mm. It just never came up, because why would it? I knew he was a different color than my mom and a different color than me and my brothers. And my mom was Danish, and we spoke Danish with her, and we spoke English with him, but that, you know, that was the amount of the difference that mattered to me. And then suddenly to figure out that when I got to Portland, people wanted me to say I was black, which was fine, except I just didn't know what that meant. And the real difficulty in it, the ultimate difficulty, was that it sacrificed what was essentially my everyday life at home, mm-hmm. where I spoke Danish, I ate Danish foods, I celebrated holidays in the Danish way, but, you know, by dancing around the Christmas tree at Christmas time and all of those kinds of things. But as soon as I walked out the door into the world, I was black, and I was totally stripped of this whole history that I had. And I think today, I mean, it's 2011, we have a biracial African-American president. I'm afraid to say it's changed, but not very much.
Yeah.
Because I get the emails now, and I get the letters, and I talk to kids, and it's still happening. Not so much in the big cities, New York, L.A., Seattle, San Francisco. I think things are probably changing a lot faster. But for all the kids in the other places where they're more isolated, they're still being forced to choose. It's such a funny thing, because we do these talks with our kids, the drug talk, mm-hmm. sex talk, mm-hmm. and we never have a race talk with kids, except to say, don't call people bad names who look different than you do. But all of these things are happening at the same time,
yeah.
and kids don't have a place to talk about what they're going through. I didn't have a place to talk about it. You know, my mom was a single mom raising three kids on her own. She was going to school, working part-time, and I didn't have the words to tell her what was going on in my life. Mm. And I'm not so sure she would have understood it because she's from Europe and didn't understand this idea of race in America, which is a terrible, horrible way that we have of separating ourselves from each other in a lot of ways.
Yeah, there's also this there's this allegiance thing in America. I think partially because we all came from other places. There's this, what were you before, and they are best. So when I was a kid, there was always like, you know, I am Irish, and that was my whole identity. I was absolutely not Irish. I had no idea what that even meant, but I was sort of raised to know that that was where we came from. And so I think there's like this categorization thing in America because when you bring together people who are from different backgrounds, they all want to be best.
Yeah, I think that's totally true. And the other part of it is it's so easy for us to just go into our different factions, to eyeball people, size them up, and then classify each other.
That's true.
In the same way that, you know, Jamie Brick is desperate to do this with birds. You know, he wants to identify them. He wants to be able to see them, name them, and then he knows them in this amazing way. But I'm thinking back right now to Vermont, where I actually started my book tour in 2010 for the hardcover. So I did my very first event as a published author at the Old Stone Church in Chester, Vermont. Misty Valley Books does this really awesome book club event for the whole weekend. It's always the last weekend of January. And I was part of the lineup, and I was first, and I was so nervous. And there must have been 200 and some people there, but there were no people of color in the audience except for my husband and maybe one other person.
Right.
And I got up there, and I was so nervous. And the first thing I thought, and here I think I'm enlightened, right? But the first thing I thought was, oh, my God, they're all white people. They're never going to get this. I mean, I'm telling on myself. I should be ashamed. But it was a big learning moment because I do the reading. I guess it goes over great. I go downstairs. The book sells out. I'm signing books, talking to people, having a great time. People are excited to read the book. Great to meet you, Heidi, on and on. And probably about maybe half a dozen people at the end of me signing the book and talking to them kind of in a whisper would say things like, my granddaughter is biracial, or my half-sister is half-Latina. And they're kind of whispering, but they're telling me the story of how they're not just white people, right?
Right.
You know, here I was looking at them and just sizing them up. Oh, they're just white people. But the thing is, they're connected to other people that I don't know about. I can't see that about them. But because they had the book, suddenly they felt permission to be able to tell, these are the people I love. These are the people I know. It's not that they were saying, I'm not just white people, but the fact is, white people are not just white people, and black people are not just black people, and Obama is Irish too, even though there's no apostrophe in his name, you know?
There's the O.
There's an O, but there's no apostrophe. And anyway, and so in that way, even for me, this has been a huge learning lesson to be able to share this story and to have people finally find permission.
Yeah.
Maybe find a language also to talk about these things, of the ways in which we're connected and mixed and all of that stuff that's so difficult to talk to in America in particular.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's wonderful that you started your tour in Vermont. That really, I think it really is maybe one of the three whitest states in the nation. So.
I know.
I think that's really interesting.
I know, but I have to tell you, I have loved Vermont. I've been to, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4 different bookstores in Vermont. I'm still hoping to get to the Galaxy Bookshop and actually meet those folks. But the book has done well in Vermont. Thank you guys very much.
Well, it's a pretty great place.
It really is.
Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about your connection to Rachel, Rachel is sort of the pivotal character in this book, and she has a background that's like yours. You've already mentioned that you were the daughter of a Danish mother and an African-American father. So I was curious if you shied away from infusing her character with your own history and outlook, or if you gravitated toward that, or if you tried not to let it weigh. You know, was there any, how did you feel about that?
I desperately tried not to write anything that had to do with me at first. The book itself is inspired by a real event that mm-hmm. happened in which a family died and the girl survived. And my original intent, my first intent, was to imagine a future for that girl, that real girl who survived, who is still out there somewhere, I imagine. I mean, I hope she's still okay. Mm-hmm. And so when I sat down to write originally, I kept her in my mind's eye because I didn't know much about her. I knew her name and I knew her age, and there was kind of a fuzzy photograph of her. And so at first, she was in my imagination, and I kept writing and writing, and it just didn't work. I was just really stuck, and I didn't get it. And then I had to go back and ask myself, why was I so invested in this story to begin with? Why was this the story that I needed to write? And I thought about it, and this still isn't a satisfactory answer, but ultimately I felt like there was something about her story that was like my own story of being half black and half white, coming to a new town, suddenly being thrust into a new identity. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, I felt like that real girl would probably have to go through those same kinds of things. There are all sorts of other reasons that I can't even articulate, and maybe if one day someone does a dissertation on my book, it will be like pre-psychoanalysis, and then I'll say, aha, that was the reason. That's really the best answer I can give still at this point.
All right, great.
But there's something very scary about putting any piece of yourself into your writing, because then not only may your writing be rejected, but then you personally feel rejected, right? Mm-hmm. That your identity isn't good enough.
Right.
And I really went through a lot of those moments with this book because it was rejected by everyone, in fact. Even after I got my agent, she sent it to about 36 different publishing houses, and it was roundly rejected over the course of a year and a half. Most of the people said there was no market for a book about a half-black, half-Danish girl. No one could relate to it. No one would be interested. And so it was, you know, heartbreaking because I had invested all this work into this story, but also to hear people say, no one cares about you. Your exact existence matters to no one whatsoever. And so there's a lot of difficulty in that, but I always think about James Baldwin, who says all art is a kind of confession. So whether or not you call it you or not you or a piece of you, there's a confession in there somehow. And that's the scary thing to do as a writer.
Yeah. Although I think to some extent it's always there, but yeah, in some ways much more overtly than others.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Heidi, I'm wondering if now would be a good time for you to read a few pages from the novel.
Yes. I'm going to read from the beginning of the book, so I don't spoil it for anyone who hasn't read. And this is one of the Jamie chapters. In fact, it's the first chapter in which you're introduced to the character Jamie, who's also known as Brick.
Okay.
Jamie thought Robbie was a bird flying down below his window. He had been waiting for this bird and ran downstairs without calling to his mother, going outside, which is what his mother had told him to say, even if she didn't hear him above the din of the television that played loudly in her room. Jamie knew that his mother was not watching television. She had a new friend in there. Jamie knew the television as something that made sounds to keep the sound out. He was okay with that. The bird he had waited for had come. Of course, it didn't have to be this one, but it was. There were any number of hundreds of birds that didn't belong in the Chicago sky. There were two windows in his apartment. One faced the alley and the other the courtyard. Jamie didn't watch out the alley window anymore. The things that he'd see fly by were never birds, but garbage bags hurled out the window from higher floors. They sometimes struck the air conditioning units below, whoop, sometimes catching there and rotting hot during summer months. Jamie, who was really James, was named after his father, but not named Junior because he was really the third. Jamie wanted a strong name like Steve or Brick. He had been Jamie since he was born, even though there was no way to confuse him with his father, James. Jamie wanted a name with a different history. Jamie, who was really James, ran downstairs to find the bird, to identify it, to see it. He would remember what he saw. He would write it down. He would record the date on his life list, the name of another bird. In his hands, he held a book. It was the only gift he had ever asked for, but the book was not a gift. His birthday, July 23rd, came and went with no celebration and no cake and no gift. So Jamie got the book from the library. When the metal detector went off, he laid on the table a pocket knife he had found in the pants, draped across the bathtub, the pants of his mother's new friend. "Young man," the stout lady library security guard said, "you know you ain't supposed to be carrying this kind of thing around." Jamie, who was really James, nodded. "I'm going to keep this here till you come back around with your mama. She says it's okay for you to have it." His plan worked. He left behind the pocket knife, but took with him the Peterson Field Guide to the Birds of Eastern and Central North America.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you very
much. I love
much.
That part.
I love that part, little dude.
Yeah,
he's great. I do. I just love him. I'm sitting here actually reading back over it instead of asking you questions, which I should be doing.
Well, I should say I actually did a reading at a library conference last year, and after I read this passage, I kind of gasped because I realized I was talking about stealing library books in front of librarians, so I apologized profusely, and they all laughed.
I'm sure they thought that Jamie would be the one person that deserved to be able to do that.
I think that's right. I think they would have given him a free pass on that.
You know, one thing that I just love about the section you read just now, it's just a really good example of something you do throughout the book, which is you introduce aspects of the plot very subtly. You know, we're learning about Jamie's mother and the way that she spends her days, but not through any sort of overt statement. You know, we hear about the TV that's up loud in her room, hiding other noises, and we hear about the pants that were draped over the bathtub. And I think that's a really wonderful way to introduce plot, especially since it's a child's point of view. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that.
One of the things that I was really trying to figure out as a new fiction writer, because this is all very new to me, was how do you know what matters just in your daily life? And what are the ways in which you experience things? And so I love this idea of the sounds that make sound, that keeps the sounds out. Like, I just, because that's exactly, still he knows what's going on, but
right.
He's very tuned into the sound. I think I'm not answering this question very well because a lot of it is still mysterious to me, but when I do sit down to write, what I'm concerned about is trying to figure out how is it this particular character hones in on what's important. What mode is this person in? Is it sound? Is it sight? Is it smell? Rachel's very tuned into smells, I noticed, only after I finished reading the book, when I was done with it. But she's very tuned into smells also, apparently. So I'm always interested in trying to figure out the story comes about from the way in which the characters experience the world. And so if I can tune in to figuring out how does the character experience the world, then I can write each sentence in that way.
Yeah. And
that was a terrible answer.
No, it's a hard question because it's a process that goes on maybe without you even understanding it as you're working. With Jamie, he's so tuned into wanting his mother's attention, though, it makes sense that all of these details are going to be filtered through his relationship with his mother and what he wants from her and what he's not getting from her.
I have to tell you that there was one interview not interview, but review that I read of the book. And really, I shouldn't do this at all, but I can't help myself, especially because now everyone's a critic. So I do actually care when people give me 1 star on Goodreads.com.
Oh, no.
It's a very sad day for me when that happens. But in any event, I read this one review, and it said, "And Brick's prostitute mother."
Oh.
And I thought, oh my God, that's so harsh. I never wrote that in there. I never wrote that she was a prostitute. Yes, she has new friends all the time, but I never wrote that. And I think it was because I was so in tune with the way that he perceived his mother, which was, this is a new friend, and she closes the door, and, you know, she needs touching. And so even in my mind as the writer, I guess that is what she is, but I would never say that about her because I'm so in tune with what Jamie thinks about her.
Isn't that interesting? It's like you are reacting through his sensibility. That's really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I felt as horrified as he would be if he had read it.
Yeah. Right. And the other thing that came up in the section that you read was that he's in Chicago. And I know you've lived in Portland. Have you lived in Chicago? Do you know Chicago well?
I don't know Chicago at all, I confess. I'm confessing right here on your show. And I know it so poorly that there is a wonderful bookseller in Chicago at Anderson's Books who read the advanced reader copy of it, so before it came out. And she said, I love this book, but there's just one thing. Those TV stations aren't Chicago TV stations. It would be not 11, 13, and whatever I had in there, but then she changed the numbers. And she told me soon enough so that we could actually change it before the book was published.
That's really interesting. I wondered if, you know, maybe that's something a copy editor would pick up on, but apparently not. They don't necessarily go into regional research.
Exactly. And so I was just so grateful for that. I will tell you the reason I said it in Chicago was that there's a very big Scandinavian community there, at least there used to be.
Okay.
And it's where Nella Larsen, who's my literary muse, was born, and she has a connection to Chicago. And I wanted to make sure that Nella was actually going to a city where she might have felt like she had some creature comfort, some home feeling about it.
Yes.
So the Scandinavian base was important in that way. And very crassly, it had to be a city with tall buildings.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
It had to be a city. And
right.
So that's why it ended up being Chicago of all places.
Right. Well, and that makes sense with Jamie's, you know, looking for the birds, you know, and having to look around buildings anyway. Yeah. Well, you mentioned Nella just now. Nella is Rachel's Danish mother. And you present Nella's point of view through the book, through journal entries. And I wondered if you always knew you wanted to present her story from her own perspective, or if you tried at first to only create her history through the people that were left behind, because she has, of course, died in the accident at the beginning.
It was actually not my own idea. It was after, I should explain that after all of these many rejections I got from these publishing houses, I then tried to get it to a smaller publishing house myself, and to no avail. And the reason the book was finally published is that it won the Bellwether Prize for Literature mm-hmm. Social Change, which comes with prize money as well as a guaranteed book contract. So my manuscript won. It was so exciting.
That is so exciting.
It was the best day ever. You really can't imagine it. I just was stunned, hysterical, so happy. And at that point, The editor, my editor, who was also one of the judges, she had notes, as well as Barbara Kingsolver and the other judge, Ernie Hebert. They all had notes for me for the manuscript before it would be ready for publication. I deleted about 150 pages from the book.
Wow.
After I won the prize, because I realized people might actually read it and it had to be better than it was.
Uh-huh.
This was the prize-winning manuscript. And then I also got the notes, and one of the notes was from my editor, Kathy. Very smart, great editor. And she said, I think we need more of Nella in here. Maybe you could try writing her journal entries. And that just scared me to death. I never would have posed that challenge to myself if she hadn't posed it to me. And I think the book is much better for it because I was putting too much on the character Lerone. She was the only advocate that Nella had, because in the end, I want the reader to feel like it was a bad choice.
Yeah.
And now I'm being kind of oblique because I don't want to ruin the book. It was a bad choice, but Nella's a good person who's in a bad moment.
Right,
you know?
Right. And we do have we have the sort of balancing perspectives of the grandmother and of Lerone that sort of make us see that we don't know Nella well. But it was a relief to get to the point where I could actually read a little bit from Nella's point of view, because I wanted to know who she had been. Sorry, I interrupted you there.
Well, I'm so glad that was rewarding to you as a reader, too, because that's what Kathy, my editor, saw was missing.
Yeah.
And I really feel like that was the best way to do it. Those journal entries were very, very difficult to write for me. I was very self-conscious about writing from the perspective of this white Danish immigrant woman.
Mm-hmm.
And so I consulted with a white Danish immigrant woman to help me figure out what those moments were that would be most important to write about as well. So I called my mom. I interviewed her for a number of those moments to try to figure out what is it that I need to include. And then my mother, I mean, she speaks fluent English, but Nella is not as fluent in her written English.
Right.
Because, of course, writing is a very different animal than actually speaking out loud.
Sure.
And so then I also struggled with making sure that the brokenness of her written language reflected a truth but didn't make her seem like she was not as prepared to be fluent in English as she actually is. Anyway, it was a very difficult balancing act, but I'm glad it worked.
Yeah. This is just kind of a trivial question, but I am curious. You had an agent already when you submitted the novel to the Bellwether.
Yes.
How did your agent react to your winning the prize? Was that like a positive thing for an agent, or?
She was so happy. So my agent is Wendy Weil, a really awesome, lovely woman.
Uh-huh.
Alice Walker's original agent and is still Alice Walker's agent.
Oh, wow.
And she represents Andrea Barrett and Mark Helprin and Rita Mae Brown and Connie Mae Fowler and all of these people who are big-time literary folks and also best-selling writers. And she really doesn't need any new clients. And so when she took me on, Wendy herself, not her assistant, not her protege, but Wendy took me on, it was just a really great honor. And she, at the end of the last submission cycle, said, you know, I'm so sorry. I love this work. I don't think that you should change it. Maybe it just is not the right time. And, you know, I still want to work with you. So if you have something new, I'd like to see it. And we just kind of left it that way. And I think she just felt really awful that it hadn't found the right editor
mm-hmm.
at the right time. And when I called her to tell her I had won, she was just over the moon about it. She, you know, it just validated the fact that she really had done her best effort, but this was the way it could come out into the world in the very best way. And it really was the very best way, because, I mean, what is better than to get a prize that says your book is about something that matters?
Yes, exactly. And we should say that the Bellwether Prize does look for that, something that sort of improves the world. I don't know how to put it.
Yeah, basically. Well, I'm looking it up now. Usually read this when I do readings, because it's so important for me that people understand that shiny gold seal on the cover is not just a shiny gold seal from
right.
the county fair. And it's not just any prize. It really is an important prize. So this is what Barbara Kingsolver, who founded the prize, says about it. She says, "Fiction has a unique capacity to bring difficult issues to a broad readership on a personal level, creating empathy in a reader's heart for the theoretical stranger. Its capacity for invoking moral and social responsibility is enormous. Throughout history, every movement toward a more peaceful and humane world has begun with those who imagine the possibilities. the Bellwether Prize seeks to support the imagination of humane possibilities. What could be better than that?
Than winning that, right?
I think that's so amazing. And so the prize, the intent is really to advocate serious literary fiction that addresses social change, issues of social change and justice,
yeah.
and the way that we can be a community better, that we can actually engage each other, maybe not with answers. I always say to people, you know, my book is sometimes unsatisfying to some readers because they're like, there are no answers in the end. And I say, well, that's life, isn't it? But don't you have a whole new set of questions? And usually the answer is, well, I do have new questions. And isn't that an exciting way to continue on with your day or the next thing that you approach?
So right.
That's my hope.
Great. Well, I do want to just know, what are you working on now?
I am working on losing the 20 pounds I've gained on the book tour.
How's that going?
Oh, it's going to be slow going, but that's the way to keep it off. In all seriousness, so yes, back to the gym. I've actually been on basically a nonstop tour since January 2010, and then the paperback came out this January, and I've just been going and going. And so finally, my desk is clear. I'm back to business. I'm working on a project that I started, thankfully, before all of the touring and the razzmatazz of being an published author has brought. And it's the same obsessions again. I mean, I was going to say it's a very different project than The Girl Fell from the Sky, but it's the same obsessions. It's inspired by, again, the life of a real woman who was half black and half white, born in the late 1850s in Poland.
Mm.
Yeah, right? That's
right.
A story right there. Like, where'd that black guy come from? So
right.
That was kind of the jumping off point for me, like, what's going on there? Well, this young woman, her stage name is Miss Lala. She became a very famous circus performer and bodybuilder, toured
wow.
throughout Europe. She was so famous that Edgar Degas did a portrait of her called Miss Lala at the Cirque Fernando,
oh, wow.
which is one of his great, great portraits, and there are many sketches of the work in progress. And so she's just a fascinating character because here is this, you know, clearly brown-skinned woman with kind of like short afro hair, but she was hailed as a beauty, and yet she was also known for the size of her biceps.
Hmm.
So this really interesting hybrid figure in both her actual body and also her racial identity.
Yeah.
In Europe. And so I wanted to explore these ideas again of, you know, what makes you who you are? It, you know, how much of your race and your culture, whatever that is, impacts the identity that you have or the one that's assigned to you. And then these ideas of beauty also, which are fascinating to me. So especially in a figure like Miss Lala, who is kind of manly-like, but is still considered beautiful and lovely, even though she's strong. So I'm really excited about what I'm doing with this book now.
Yeah,
no. So it's got all these great figures in it.
How much exists that helps you know who she was? Did she write letters or journals, or is it all sort of?
I think I'm writing them.
I wonder. Okay.
I mean, this is why it's a work of fiction. Not much is known about her at all, and I think I am the world's foremost expert on her at this point. I really have done a ton of research. I got a wonderful grant from the Elizabeth George Foundation. Elizabeth George, the mystery writer, has a foundation that
okay.
supports writers. And I got a check from her for several thousands of dollars to go to Paris for a month, all expenses paid. And I did research there, and I found some more information out about her. But no, there are so many gaps in it. And so, again, instead of focusing on the gaps of information, in the same way that I had so little information about the real girl that inspired The Girl Who Fell from the Sky,
right.
I've had to go back and investigate the reason I'm so obsessed with Miss Lala. And that's the space I'm trying to work with in writing the story at this point.
That sounds really interesting. How far are you?
I'm not very far along at all. I couldn't even say when a publication date would be, but I'm hoping I'll be done with it by next year.
Yeah.
And if all continues to go well. The funny thing about writing books is I think you have to learn how to write not books, but this book and then the next book that you're writing. And each book has its own way of being written. So I'm settling into how this book wants to be written. I can tell you this right now, even though I've gone on and on about Miss Lala in this moment,
yeah.
Right now the central voice of the book is actually Miss Lala's lover, Jules, who is not actually a character in real life at all, but that was the first voice that came to me, and that's the voice of the book at this point.
Well, maybe Jules is the witness.
I'm thinking maybe it's another kind of Brit character,
yeah.
In fact, yeah. And maybe that's how books are, and maybe that's how writers write.
Yeah.
So we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Well, Heidi, I just have one last question for you. I heard you speak on a panel at the AWP conference in Washington, D.C. this year.
Oh, yes. That was so great.
Yeah, that was a great panel. And it concerned short story and novel writing. And actually, the panel talked about a number of different ways of looking at possible sort of interplay between the forms. I'm wondering if you have any advice from your own experience with The Girl Who Fell from the Sky for writers who are interested in working to either combine stories into a novel or create and separately publish stories from a novel in progress.
Oh, man. I said some smart things that day, but I feel like I don't know any pithy, good advice at this point. I mean, one thing I can say is if you are trying to put short stories into a book, be very aware that you're probably going to have to change the short story, because if it works as a short story, it doesn't really work as a chapter in many ways, because short stories close so many things off,
mm-hmm.
and chapters need to open things up and
yeah.
create more possibilities
right.
in each chapter. And so that is one of the main difficulties. And I remember sitting down and realizing, oh, man, but this was so good as the short story. But I had to let some stuff go.
Yeah.
I had to change it around a lot. And so, yeah, I think you just have to be willing to let it change. And the other part of that, though, is that I really feel like I don't know how to write a short story.
Oh, really?
I'm not so sure. Now, I've won a short story competition, in fact, a couple of them. But I feel like I'm not so sure about that because I always want to say more. And
mm-hmm.
the short story is just too short of a form for me. I feel like the backstory is so important, and it's difficult to fit a lot of that into anything but a novel.
Did you write your chapters and then turn them into stories, or did you take stories and turn them into chapters?
I took a bunch of paragraphs and I put paper clips on them and I called them stories. I'm not entirely joking here.
Yeah.
I really, at some point, was in this mode where I thought, I have got to just send something out. And I took all of my best paragraphs and put them together. And the first short story I published look something like the first chapter of the book, but not exactly, not really. The short story, I think, was good. The first chapter is better because it does have that opening up quality to it.
Okay, all right.
So I advise people to get paper clips.
Okay, we're all running right out.
Okay.
Thank you very much for having been on this show. It was really fun to talk to you.
Thank you. It was great. I enjoyed it.
And I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Heidi Duro as well. You can learn more about the work of Heidi Duro at her website, heidiwduro.com, and her last name is spelled D-U-R-R-O-W. I'm afraid we're a little short on time this week for the Bookworms calendar, but we will bring it back next week. I am, however, going to do the Write the Book prompt, and this week's prompt was inspired by the work of my guest, Heidi Duro, and by our interview. In our conversation, Heidi spoke about the difference between writing short fiction, which tends to find endings and closure, and longer fiction, which needs to open up possibilities that lead into the next part of the novel. This week, write about a character who witnesses something extraordinary. First, write a 500-word story about the situation in which you offer closure, and perhaps try to create a short story. And then write 500 words that might belong within a larger work of fiction, a chapter that asks questions and opens up the situation for further exploration in the rest of the work. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you are interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know. They can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And that's also the email address to which you can send writing prompts if you're interested. I'm happy to credit you for any writing prompt that you might share if I choose to use it on the show. That email address, again, is writethebook@gmail.com. So we're going to put some music on here for you. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator. 105.9 FM, WOMM-LP, Burlington, Vermont. Thank you.